The American History Podcast, Season 2, Episode 28, The Battle of Buena Vista.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Okay, welcome back. As always, it is my pleasure to be here. And before we get started, let me just remind you, go to the website, check it out. We got posters. We got pictures and a map of this battle. Might help those of you who are less familiar with this this information kind of visualize it. The address is www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email list, and you can also check out some of the sources that we've used to make these episodes. You can also check out some show notes for each episode, like I said, some of which are more detailed than others. I would encourage you to check those out, especially, like I said, for this episode, because we've got a map and some photos, and it's really just going to help you visualize these things. Okay, speaking of email, I've had some trouble with the old email address, so if you want to email me with questions or comments, please send the emails to Sean Worswick at mac.com. That's my name, Sean Worswick, S-H-A-W-N-W-A-R-S-W-I-C-K, at mac.com. If you're into social media, you can check us out on Twitter, at American Hiscast. And finally, if you'd like to support the show, help us out, help us keep the lights on, that sort of thing, there's two ways that you can do it. First, you can head over to iTunes and give us a five-star rating, or if you've got a bit of time, give us a five-star review. That helps people find the show, and it's a free way for you to support us. The second way to support the show is to become a member of our Patreon page. Now, if you don't know what Patreon is, this is a site for content creators. We have various support levels, but for $3 a month, you will have access to a bonus episode every month. Just like the free show, the Patreon show is topical. Right now we are covering the Cold War, and the theme is the year 1983, the year the world ended, almost ended. So head over there and join up. It's a really good deal. I mean, $3 a month, it's cheaper than a Starbucks drink, and this helps to support the show. And as I've heard it stated once or twice before from someone, it helps to keep history alive. All right, so this episode is going to pick up where the last one left off. But before we do, here's the song of the week. This week, it is a song titled The Hobo's Lullaby. See you on the other side.
Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let this town drift slowly by. When you hear the steel rails humming, tomorrow, let tomorrow come and go. Tonight you'll have a nice warm boxcar, safe from all the rain and snow. Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let this town drift slowly by. When you hear the steer is humming, that's the hobo's lullaby. Oh, how happy. That's the hobo's lullaby. Ollie, ole, oh. Ollie, ole, oh. Ollie, ole.
So we left off last time with things coming together in such a way that the American leadership was finally aware that this was going to be no splendid little war. They had realized the Mexicans were going to put up a fight, and thus the leadership in Washington began to make preparations to extend the war towards the capital city itself. In January 1847, both General Winfield Scott and Zachary Taylor were worried about the possibility of an attack by Santa Anna. Santa Anna had come to possess the American plan, and the Americans were aware of this fact. However, they misjudged the way the Mexican leader would react. They were both of the opinion that Scott's landing at Veracruz was most likely to be the target. If that were the case, Santa Anna would be unable to attack Taylor, as he could not be in two places at once. Thus, Scott planned on writing Taylor, suggesting that he should move southward towards San Luis Potosi. Now, this made sense, militarily speaking, for Santa Anna to attempt to deal with Scott. A landing is always difficult, especially in hostile territory. Add to the fact that this is the mid-19th century, not the mid-20th century, and the prospects of the Americans being defeated increased. I mean, let's be honest, this isn't the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps in World War II, okay? However, as I mentioned in the previous episode, Santa Anna was only concerned about one thing, elevating his own status in the eyes of the Mexican people. Instead of taking out Scott, he was more concerned with defeating Taylor in the north. Thus, in late January, the lead elements of the Mexican force left San Luis Potosi. This group was comprised of artillery, a battalion of engineers, and the San Patricio Company of American Deserters. A division of infantry would follow each of the following 3 days, and finally the headquarters would move out north on February 2nd. So, while the army had improved, the fact was the Mexican soldiers knew what awaited them. Thus, while they were determined, they were also sad, and there were many tearful farewells were said, as many figured they would not be seeing their loved ones again. Now, it was almost as if the streak of bad luck that followed the Mexican army was playing a game. Things had improved just enough to make some think the situation could be salvaged. But once they were on the march, the bad luck returned. On the day of departure, 3 men and one of the divisions died of exposure. And from that point forward, fatigue set in amongst the troops. To make matters worse, the weather was bad, and the army was soaked by freezing rain, which lasted for a week, which was quite unusual for that part of the country. Finally, on February 5th, there was a respite in the poor weather. However, that was the point at which the troops left the cultivated lands and entered the desert we mentioned in the last episode that lay in between San Luis Potosi and Saltillo. Okay. Thus, the weather immediately began to warm up and was soon extremely hot. By February 17, the lead division, led by Don Francisco Pacheco, arrived at a town called Encarnacion, having marched 300 miles in 3 weeks. The march itself wasn't hard. The weather is what made it difficult. To add to these difficulties, Santa Anna had ordered the water tanks along their route destroyed just a few weeks prior to their marching up the route to meet the Americans. The reason was that he had hoped to deprive the Americans of water should they decide to attack San Luis Potosi. The surprising thing is that in the end, 15,000 of the original 20,000 troops made it. The other 5,000, either having deserted, died, or abandoned their post. The weak were gone, and the strong had survived. It was these soldiers who would be taking on Taylor's outnumbered forces. Now, on February 20th, 1847, Taylor ordered the 1st Dragoons to reconnoiter the area to the south of Agua Nueva. The Dragoons would be accompanied or were accompanied by Ben McCulloch's company of Texas Rangers, and according to one witness, the 1st Dragoons was the best the U.S. Army had to offer. The force was led by Army Lieutenant Colonel Charles May, who was promoted to Brevet Lieutenant Colonel due to his capture of Mexican General La Vega and Resaca de la Palma. May led the command south, and after a few miles, they captured a Mexican lancer who refused to give any information to the enemy. Several hours later, the advance guard, led by Lieutenant Samuel Chamberlain, came across a hacienda and a cloud of dust. The dust in the distance could be one of two things, either cattle or a large army. Of course, it was the latter. May caught up with the advance party and set about preparing the hacienda for a defense, even though he believed the dust was only cattle. The Americans had, by the way, captured several more Mexican soldiers by this point. These soldiers were put to work preparing the breastworks and the artillery, and yes, they brought several pieces with them, which were wheeled into place. The horses were groomed and fed, and then the cattle were herded in and slaughtered, at least some of them were, and the soldiers were able to eat fairly well that evening. Now, at this point, a horseman appeared on the horizon, about a mile or so off, the sun glittering off their lances. It was impossible to determine how many troops there were, but now May was convinced they had indeed come across the main body of Santa Anna's army. By now, May ordered his soldiers to prepare to mount a defense. All extra animals were released, and the Mexican prisoners were executed. The rest of the evening was quiet, until a scouting party returned with word they had encountered no enemy forces, but they did stumble upon an encampment. May ordered his men to horse, in other words, to mount up, and the command moved back north in the dark. Needless to say, this order should have been given much earlier, as the road north would have been difficult to follow in the dark. Sure enough, the journey was not easy. Gunfire rumbled in the distance, and a line of horsemen appeared off their flank. Furthermore, the rough road was made more so in the dark, and horses fell in prairie dog holes, things of that nature. Luckily for May and his men, they made it back to the main body of the American army with no further incident. General Taylor was unconcerned and ordered the 400 men, all of whom had just ridden approximately 80 miles in 24 hours without sleep, to go ahead and get some rest. In the end, the troops May had seen were indeed the advanced units of Santa Anna's army. Now the Mexican leader had a bit of a decision to make himself. He could either continue up the main road or move around east and possibly surprise Taylor. Santa Anna chose the former, as it was the easier and shorter route. Another problem that he had, one of which he and everyone else in his army was unaware, Ben McCulloch, the Texas Ranger, had somehow managed to blend in with the scene and was able to see everything the Mexican army was doing. Now one might ask, how was this possible? Well, mainly it's possible because of the fact that the Mexican army was preparing to move, and thus they were in a state of disarray. Eventually, the audacious Texan slipped away and made his way back to Taylor around midday on February 21st. He reported Santa Anna was near, and now it was apparent to Taylor that he had a battle on his hands. General Wool, who was technically senior to Taylor, based on the fact that he had served longer, suggested the army should retreat to Angostura, which was an ideal defensive position, especially considering the fact that the Americans were again outnumbered. For his part, General Taylor had no problem fighting long odds. After all, he'd been doing that for the entirety of this war. However, prudence won out, and he assented to the retreat. Thus, on February 22nd, the Americans arrived at the Angostura Pass in good order and ready to set up to meet the Mexican advance. Santa Anna and his army were at Carnero Pass that morning, expecting an easy victory against the smaller American force. However, when they discovered the American camp at Agua Nueva, it was in flames, and Santa Anna again had made a mistake. He believed the Americans panicked and fled. Thus, he pushed his already exhausted and parched men forward, giving them very little time to even fill their canteens. As his army approached La Angostura, he realized that victory here would be costly. At Agua Nueva, the ground was perfect for frontal assaults by both infantry and cavalry, but here the land was different. When Taylor on the 21st had decided to take General Wool's advice, he left the field to Wool and decided to move back to Saltillo accompanied by the 1st Dragoons. He knew Wool was capable of organizing the defenses perhaps better than Taylor himself was, and Taylor was worried about the possibility of envelopment in the rear by the Mexican cavalry. There were plenty of secondary roads which made this a real possibility. On the morning of the 22nd, it was apparent that nothing of importance would take place at Saltillo, and so Taylor decided to once again move 6 miles away back to Buena Vista. To the south, Wool had only 4,750 men to try to establish a defensible position against the 14,000 or so that was possessed by Santa Anna. This army was not only small, but green. The artillery and the dragoons were certainly regulars, but only 700 out of the almost 4,800 had ever seen combat. However, the ground was perfect for a defense, and Wool organized his forces masterfully. The terrain picked by Taylor and Wool offered only 3 feasible avenues for approach. There was the main road to the front and 2 ridges which led around Wool's left flank. Naturally, Wool's first priority was to secure the road coming up from San Luis Potosi, along which Santa Anna's army was marching. Luckily for the Americans, it was the easiest to defend, as it bottlenecked to a pass of only 40 feet wide, limited to the east by steep cliffs and to the west by a small river, which was sliced up by gullies that were so steep they were impassable. To cover the main road, Wool placed three guns of Washington's artillery battery almost on the road, protected by the 1st Illinois, part of which was to the right and the rest of which was to the left. Now, the second approach was more dangerous than the first, and it was the broad plain to the east of the main road, leading to the nose that was occupied in part by the 1st Illinois. Unchecked, the Mexicans could march right up to the American position and smash through. To protect what was a plateau, Wool positioned or posted the 2nd Indiana Infantry. It was reinforced by three guns from Washington's battery, the 2nd Illinois, along with two guns from Bragg's battery, and the 2nd Kentucky with three guns from Sherman's battery. These regiments were positioned in an oblique, so most likely the Indiana boys would be the first hit, were an attack to come from that direction. Now, if you're confused by all this, I would suggest you go to the website and see the map, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, the third avenue of attack was one which led around Wool's position and straight to Buena Vista. However, the ridge was relatively narrow and long. This would mean you'd have a journey of about 4 miles compared to the 1.5 mile journey on the plateau. At this point, Wool felt it was unlikely the Mexican army would take that third route, and so he left it undefended. February 22nd dawned clear and frosty. Would see some sparring between the two armies. Santa Anna's army was, by this point, exhausted. Having said that, his plan was solid, based on solid military practices of the time. He would have a division attack down the main road on the left. The majority of his forces would attack from the right, which was Wool's left, advancing down the plateau. The problem was that it would take time to move his troops into place, and they were not yet ready by the end of the day. In the meantime, Taylor reappeared around 11 a.m. on the 22nd. Now, Wool might be more than competent, but the hero, at least to his men, was Taylor. Soon afterwards, a messenger arrived with a message from Santa Anna. The Mexican dictator said, quote, "You are surrounded by 20,000 men and cannot, in any human probability, avoid suffering a rout and being cut to pieces with your troops. But as you deserve consideration and particular esteem, I wish to save you from a catastrophe. And for that purpose, I give you this notice in order that you may surrender at discretion under the assurances that you will be treated with the consideration belonging to the Mexican character, to which you will be granted an hour's time to make up your mind, to commence from the moment when my flag of truce arrives in your camp, God and liberty," end quote. Now, Taylor reacted, according to witnesses, profanely, although his written response was mild, if sarcastic. Quote, "In reply to your note of this date, summoning me to surrender my forces at discretion, I beg leave to say that I decline acceding to your request," end quote. Now, on the other side, Santa Anna tried to make the most of his situation. Two infantry divisions under the commands of Major Generals Manuel Maria Lombardi and Francisco Pacheco held the center with 14 artillery pieces as backup. His best troops, Blanco's engineers, were on the left, with three 16-pounders on the high ground just behind them. On the right were Ampudia's light infantry and Brigadier General Julian Huvera's heavy cavalry brigade, along with two artillery batteries. Now, let me just remind you, the Mexican artillery was not as accurate or of the same quality as that which the Americans possessed. So even though they did have artillery, the Mexican artillery was pretty much useless. Now, the battle itself began at 3 p.m. that day with the exchange of gunfire between a brigade of Mexican troops led by Colonel Santiago Blanco, and the Americans at the Narrows. However, this was, of course, just a feint. The main thrust by the Mexican army was on the left, to the east, as Santa Anna had discovered that Wool had left the east flank fairly open, covered only by dismounted cavalry in between the mesa and the tall ridge to the east. The idea was for Ampudia and Huvera to take the high ground, which gave access to Wool's rear. Unfortunately for the Mexicans, their advance was bogged down, and Wool transferred several companies to the area. As darkness descended, the shooting came to an end, and both sides settled in for the night. The night, though, turned bitterly cold, especially for this area, and thanks to a heavy rain, neither army could light any fires. Relief parties brought both food and blankets to the American soldiers who were huddled up on the slopes of the ridge, but the Mexican soldiers got neither, and instead had to suffer through the darkness. Now, both Taylor and Santa Anna showed themselves in this battle to be lacking in tactics. The Mexican leader was sound when it came to planning an action, but he lacked in execution. His plan to mount a great assault against the center-left with Pacheco and Lombardi's men was sound. His problem? He was too easily diverted, in this case with the temptation that the enemy's far left could be turned. The American left was already immobile thanks to the positioning of Ampudia and Juvera. It would have been wise to do what Wool did not think they could or would do, and move forces the 4 miles around the aforementioned third way. Taylor himself was again able to convince himself that Saltillo was vulnerable to Mexican cavalry. So he took Colonel Jefferson Davis's Mississippians and May's Dragoons and, after dark, checked on the garrison at Saltillo. Satisfied that it was safe, he returned on the morning of the 23rd with the Mississippians not far behind. They had now spent a day and a night marching south, then north, and then south again. On the morning of the 23rd, it was apparent that Wool was in trouble. His 3,000 troops were spread over too large an area, and it was obvious that Santa Anna wanted to turn the left of the Americans, as the Americans there could hear reinforcements moving up towards them. And during the night, the Mexicans had moved 5 8-pound artillery pieces to the high ground overlooking the American lines, which were about 800 yards off. This was close enough for the cannons, which, as I said earlier, were faulty, to be effective. Now, as the sun rose, Santa Anna tried some psychological warfare. He had buglers blow reveille for different units at different times to make the army sound bigger than it was. Bands filled the air with music, while the infantry and the cavalry deployed in a long line. The show was certainly impressive, and it worried the Americans, one officer later noting, quote, "the cavalry was magnificent," end quote. He counted about 6,000 cavaliers who were richly uniformed in blue coats faced with red, waving plumes and glittering weapons. As they slowly advanced, the Americans were sure they were about to be overrun. The infantry came forward, and the two great arms formed a great colorful line. Now, the real show began as Ampudia pressed north, driving the Anglo forces back. This was an attempt to clear the way for Juvera's cavalry to sweep down and into the enemy rear. On the Mexican left, Blanco's engineers, supported by the cavalry, punched up the road until the American artillery guarding it devastated their ranks. Soon, smoke spread over the battlefield. Ampudia steadily advanced under withering fire from the Americans, and before long, a gap did open up in the Anglo left. Lombardini's division charged out of an arroyo onto the mesa, and in a startling parade ground maneuver, formed a column of brigades. Next, Pacheco's division came up, while Ortega's division and Juvera's brigade moved in as support. In all, 7,000 Mexican soldiers stormed into the 2nd Indiana, which was backed up by all of 3 guns. Led by General Lane, the Indiana boys were ordered by Wool to hold the line at all costs. Bloody gaps were torn into the Mexican flanks by the muskets and the artillery, yet they continued their advance. The brunt of the damage was borne by Pacheco's division, with 2 battalions scattering in disorder. Riding close behind Lombardini and Pacheco was Santa Anna himself, at least until his horse was shot out from under him. General Lombardini was wounded, and yet the Mexican forces continued to pound the Hoosiers. Devastating fire from the Mexicans caused the colonel of the 2nd Indiana to order his men to cease fire and retreat. They turned and ran, leaving 90 casualties and a 4-pounder on the field. Things were looking bad for the Americans at this point. By 9 a.m., Wool's position was starting to disintegrate, and it was at this point that Taylor arrived with his dragoon escort, informing Wool that the Mississippians were close behind. Wool informed Taylor of the deteriorating situation, and he advised that a general retreat might be needed. However, the presence of Taylor appeared to stiffen the spine of everyone involved. Leaving Wool in tactical command, Taylor himself took position near one of the artillery batteries on the road. Major William Bliss, for whom Fort Bliss is named, rode down the line and returned to the general to tell him that he believed they were whipped. Taylor responded, quote, "I know it, but the volunteers don't know it. Let them alone, and we'll see what they do," end quote. Now, according to historian David Clary, the Americans did have one advantage. Yes, the Mexican soldiers were just as ferocious as any in the world. However, they were bad shots. The same could not be said of their enemy. Just as things looked dark for Taylor's army, the Mississippi Rifles arrived. Their orders were to shield Buena Vista along with both the Arkansas and Kentucky Cavalry, the 3rd Indiana, and Captain Enoch Steen's Dragoons. This strengthened the left. The center was still holding, and the right was, as it had been solid. It was at this point that things went to hell on the Yankee left. Huveta's cavalry was moving forward and aiming for the supply train. Wool sent his regular dragoons to the area, and they found Colonel Archibald Yale of the Arkansas Cavalry and Colonel Humphrey of the Kentucky Horsemen arguing about who was senior. When Huveta's lead men arrived, most of the volunteers fled, except for a handful around Yale. Now, the colonel fell in action while the dragoons hit Huveta's column and split it in two. The advance continued, drawing murderous fire from the artillery that was guarding the north. Further, the dragoons chased the Mexican cavalry. Adding to this came volleys and a charge by the Mississippi Rifles and other infantry in and around Buena Vista. This destroyed what was left of Huveta's men, with many fleeing into the mountains to the east. Santa Anna was still convinced that his superior numbers could prevail, even though the American artillery and musket fire was decimating his soldiers. Shifting his men around, a new column stormed the mesa at around 5 p.m. This group ran into a hail of shot and canister from the artillery that Wool had shifted around to meet this new challenge. Next, Anglo troops counterattacked. A motley collection of men from three different regiments, they crashed into the Mexican forces led by General Francisco Perez just as they crested the mesa. The result was hand-to-hand combat, with bodies falling like flies on both sides. The Americans poured artillery fire and blasted bloody holes into the enemy forces. However, the Mexican soldiers continued to press forward, forcing the Anglos to retreat, leaving behind two guns. Taylor ordered another battery forward to hold the position. Led by Major Braxton Bragg, Taylor ordered them to fire double loads of canister into the enemy. The first salvo was so devastating it shocked the Mexicans, and the advance halted. The next two volleys drove it back, and Perez retreated from the plateau with what was left of his men. Smoke drifted over a horrific scene. Dead and dying, men and horses, their bodies shattered, lay everywhere. The Division of the North had given all it could, performing beyond anyone's expectations. But it was over. Santa Anna took one last stab at the Americans around sunset, sending a cavalry brigade against the American right, still protected by a battery on the road. The result was predictable. Men and horses were shredded. Suddenly, it began to rain, and the Battle of Buena Vista was over. The American artillery had won the day against ferocious Mexican cavalry and infantry troops. Santa Anna's army simply had nothing to match the gunnery on the other side. However, the Mexicans, in the words of David Clary, levied a great butcher's bill on the invaders. Taylor's army was exhausted and almost out of ammunition. He had lost 673 men killed and wounded, and about 1,500 soldiers had deserted during the fighting. The victory, if it was truly a victory, belonged to Wool, at least in Clary's estimation, and to our artillery, in my estimation. Had the Mexican army not retired from the field, and instead attacked again on the morning of the 24th, they might have utterly destroyed Taylor's command. However, that did not happen. Santa Anna had lost 591 killed in action, 1,048 wounded, and had 1,894 missing, 300 of whom were prisoners of the North Americans. The Napoleon of the West ordered his soldados to move out quietly after nightfall and retire to Agua Nueva. He then held a council of war on February 25th, and the council advised retreat. Thus the so-called soldier of the people climbed into his fancy carriage, summoned his personal guard, loaded up his fighting chickens, and hightailed it back to the capital, leaving his army to fend for itself. Taylor did not pursue the Mexican forces, although he did move south to Agua Nueva, but went no further. Amongst the dead on the American side was Henry Clay Jr., the third son of Henry Clay, who was a vocal opponent of the war, and of course had run against President Polk in 1844. Another of the casualties amongst the Americans was John J. Hardin of Illinois, a Whig and a political rival of Abraham Lincoln. While the immediate reason for this defeat was Santa Anna's inability to stick to the plan, the long-term reason was a condition that he had helped to bring about. Again, referring to David Clary, since 1821, Mexico had a disorganized government, a corrupt army and civil service, and continual public chaos. They had kept Mexico poor. Wars, of course, cost money, and while the Napoleon of the West tried, he could never produce enough to clothe, equip, and feed his troops. His own corruption made this worse, as he abused his soldiers to death by the way he conducted the march north. While he cared nothing for the men who served under him, he was able to make them think that he had their best interest at heart, and they often fought ferociously for him. All of this without decent weapons or equipment. Indeed, they were a far better army than Santa Anna deserved. Even in the face of these odds, Santa Anna was able to almost defeat Taylor. One wonders what the outcome of this battle would have been had Mexico not suffered from these problems for several decades. Heck, one wonders if the United States would have decided to engage in a war against a Mexico that was strong and well-run. As for the Division of the North, the march to San Luis Potosi, through the same harrowing conditions as before, destroyed it. One reporter noted, quote, "The army seemed made up of dead men. The miserable conditions to which the sick were reduced caused the skin of many to stick to their bones, and its shrinking exposed their teeth, giving to the countenance the expression of a forced laugh, which filled one with horror," end quote. Because they had no way to transport their wounded, about 800 men were left to die in the cold desert, with coyotes and feral dogs closing in. Thanks to the cold, lack of food and water, dysentery and desertion, about 3,000 more men would die on the march south. In the meantime, Santa Anna, who had raced to the capital, proclaimed a great victory. Church bells rang, and for a little while, most people believed him. Okay, that is all I've got for this time. I think that's a pretty sad note to leave on. Next time, we will turn our gaze south, and we will analyze the Battle of Veracruz. Until next time, have a great day.